Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Dagna Milovanvic from Disability Rights International. So tell me a little bit about your disabilities work.
I've been working in disability field for almost 15 years now, and I went all the way through providing direct support to young people with intellectual disabilities and developing services in the community. Since 2006, I've been involved in human rights advocacy, so basically monitoring human rights of persons with disabilities, monitoring situation in institutions where people are kept isolated, and exposing human rights abuses that occur first in Serbia, but also in Europe, in the region.
So, what are some of the biggest human rights issues when it comes to institutionalization?
Well, the biggest human rights issues are definitely unlawful segregation and isolation, because people are kept in institutions just on the basis of their disability. So there is no justification other than that they're separated because of their disability. Of course, use of restraint and isolation are a huge concern. And people are kept in isolation cells, either in isolation rooms that resemble cells, actually, as a measure of punishment, or because their behavior is not understood if they're not really able to communicate in a typical manner. So because of this misunderstanding of a person's condition, they're really treated in non-human way.
So,
other issues are also over medication, that people are kept sedated for prolonged periods of time, denial of medical care, and the list is really long. And it depends, of course, on type of institution, on particular country, but definitely in all institutions, people are exposed to human rights abuses more or less.
So, are you aware of any projects that are working to counter this activity? Anything that's trying to go in there and say, hey, you can't do that to these people?
Well, definitely. Besides my organization, Disability Rights International, there are also human rights, local human rights organizations, which are drawing attention to this situation. And there are many initiatives in different countries. In Serbia, for example, after our report in 2007, the major reform has started. and a lot of resources have been drawn to the institutionalized personal children. And the number of children has been significantly reduced. But the problem is that many adults still remain in institutions. And most worrisome human rights abuses are still existing. So it's really a long, it takes a long time to achieve measurable changes, that's really significant improvements. But even the smallest ones are as important, because if we affect a single person's life, then we can say that we achieved something.
So, in your work, has there been a success like that, a moment where real change did take place?
For example, in Europe, there was a situation in Turkey when the report was released that the use of electroconvulsive treatment without anesthesia was immediately banned, because it was used previously. Again, in Georgia, they started providing treatment for children with hydrocephalus that wasn't provided before. But the real, like, structural systemic changes are really take a long time. So we can only see attempts of governments to implement these changes, such as adopting new laws, like in Serbia. New social welfare law was adopted, limiting the maximum number of people in institutions, and also starting some pilot projects that led to several hundreds of people leaving institutional setting and start living in the community.
So, if you could send any message to the communities and to society about why people with disabilities should be included and treated with human rights and dignity, what would you say?
All people are born equal, and people with or without disabilities should have, do have the same right to live a dignified life in the community. So disability can never be a justification for any sort of division, any sort of isolation, segregation. People must be awarded same opportunities, same rights as everyone else, because disability is just a variation of human existence. It's not something to be afraid of. It's not something to be that we have to keep away from other people. There are no others and us. We are all equal and born equal, and all should live life with equal opportunity.
So what steps do you think we as a society can take to make sure more gets done?
Well, first we have to start from ourselves, and very useful question that we each of us can ask ourselves is what if I were in the same place, or what if it happens to me, what kind of life and what kind of support would I want to lead? So it can happen to any of us, so it's not about us and them. So each of us has to work on ourselves, on our prejudice, on our misconceptions, because although I've been working for a long time supporting persons with disabilities, and I've been living with epilepsy my whole life as well, so although living in with challenges and supporting, working with other people who experience different challenges in their life, I still catch myself, you know, with some thoughts that are really not justified in real life. So we have to question ourselves all the time, and first of all support ourselves, our community, and start from there, because the community is the best, should have should provide support for all its members. So start from our home, from our backyard, and then only that way we can achieve more meaningful changes for the whole society.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Next up, we'll hear from Pamela Mertz about an information campaign for military personnel who stutter.
So the National Stuttering Association has always had at its core that we provide advocacy, support, and resources to children, teenagers, adults who stutter, and their parents and their loved ones and the professionals that work with people who stutter. But we've never really delved into special pop populations. And a special population has always been there, but came across my purvey, and it was requested that the NSA put some energy and resources behind developing specific resources and support for active duty military personnel, as well as utilizing the insights that retired or veteran personnel have had from having been in the military and had experience with stuttering.
So
we in fact opened the very first National Stuttering Association military support chapter on an Air Force base last year. And that's pretty exciting that it's the first of its kind in the U.S. And we're looking to expand upon that.
So how does stuttering impact someone in military service? What sort of reaction might they get?
Yeah, so one of the reasons that we're really interested in doing some awareness raising and education for military personnel, not just enlisted members, but people in the military who have authority positions. So typically, a person who stutters can be medically disqualified from serving simply because they stutter. So it's not always the case. People who stutter are able to get through with waivers if they're going after a post or a particular job opportunity that would not require, you know, rapid, fast-paced communication. So it impacts people serving in the military because having it sort of out there as more or less a policy of the military that one can be disqualified, individuals who stutter often will not voluntarily disclose that they stutter when they are meeting with recruiters to enlist. So then what you have is people who stutter obviously getting through and serving, because there's definitely people who stutter in the military here, but you have this subset population of individuals who now they have to keep it hidden because they fear perhaps that they could be disqualified from the military, or they fear that they would be stigmatized, or they fear that if they're found stuttering or not speaking as fluently as a counterpart, that could have some adverse effect on their performance.
So
it was brought to our attention, like, hey, we've got people in the National Stuttering Association community that are in the military. Let's see how we can provide support for them.
So how has this program proven effective, not just on their overall performance, but on the morale of those who stutter and are involved in military service?
Mm-hmm. So honestly, it's a new initiative. It's only been ongoing for just a little over a year. So we're in the process of developing what we're planning to label the Military Support Network of the NSA, so the MSN of the NSA. And so far, what we have created is a closed Facebook forum that offers active duty and retired military personnel the opportunity to get together, share stories and resources and support. And we have speech language therapists who are now particularly interested in, well, how can we help provide the treatment, perhaps, and the support that active duty military needs? We also just recently created a informational educational awareness video that includes 7 individuals from various branches of the military here in the United States talking freely about, I am in the Coast Guard, I am in the Air Force, I am in the Navy, I stutter, and it has not limited my ability to serve my country and do my job. So we're hoping that having an awareness vehicle like that will help us educate the people that make the decisions about whether or not a potential recruit, particularly young people looking at the military as a career path, so to remove those barriers.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Have you ever thought about volunteering with CJAM FM? Why haven't you? Volunteering isn't limited to students. Anyone from the community can come into the station and start their very own program. All you need are a pair of headphones and the enthusiasm to learn. So get involved right here in your community with a topical spoken word show or music program where you choose the content. Email programcjam@gmail.com or come on down to the station. We're located on the University of Windsor campus in the basement of the CAW Student Center. Find out more information about how you can volunteer at cjam.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex, I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from the National Stuttering Association, Disability Rights International. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Dr. Huma Sadie. So tell me a little bit about your mental health work.
By profession, I'm a registered psychotherapist, which basically means I have a master's in counseling. But I've been in the field for about 16 years, give or take. And it really just started with needing my master's and kind of really starting to do some of that work in terms of in the mental health field. I started doing work mainly with people who had psychotic disorder. So what you would traditionally find to be more severe. But really, really enjoying the work. So I started in research, and then I really enjoyed connecting with the people and seeing some of the change that can happen. So that kind of started my career path down into the mental health field, where now I'm been at the same clinic working with primarily clients dealing with PTSD, trauma-related issues, seeing them for assessment and treatment. And now I just recently actually started my own private practice, really focusing in on trauma-related therapy.
So past guest Sukaina has mentioned you're tied to a couple of interesting organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little about that?
Sure. One of the organizations is called Nasiha, which is an organization that focuses on mental health needs, concerns, primarily in the Muslim community. So it's an interesting model. What they do is they have a helpline portion where people can call in anyone, where it's anonymous, confidential, non-judgmental. So basically just have someone, a peer, talk to. But I'm actually on the other side of the team, which is on education and outreach. So it's really about getting into the communities and doing some of the preventive education work in terms of what is mental illness, what are some of the symptoms and signs, how that it impacts the Muslim community like it does all other communities, but to do it in a culturally sensitive way, to really start building those connections, doing the workshops, getting the word out, which has been, you know, pretty amazing and eye-opening to just kind of seeing it done in the community this way, where traditionally marginalized communities have limited access to mental health treatment or just even education around it.
So
other organization that I am involved with is called NISA Homes, which is a transitional home for women and children who, for a variety of reasons, are homeless, whether it be due to domestic violence, poverty, being a refugee or having no status in the country. And its focus is on the Muslim community, but we take women and children from all faiths. It's just that it gives it that extra lens and that framework that we are culturally sensitive in that, as in terms of the food, the environment, that is more conducive perhaps to the Muslim women and children, but we don't discriminate based on who comes into the home. So I volunteer there as a counselor. So I see the women individually when they come into the home for therapy. So whether it be working on their current stressors, so in terms of the stress of having to live in the home, in a transitional home, trying to access services, stress and the anxiety they feel, or even getting into some of the traumas that they have endured and to come up with strategies and plans moving forward.
So for Muslim families coming in, mm-hmm. do you find there's a difficulty in navigating the system, something Sukaina had referenced?
Mm-hmm. I think for, to be honest with you, majority of Canadians, it's a hard system to navigate. I think when you add in the layer of, for some people, it's whether it be language, I think there's an additional level of stigma in the Muslim community, as there is with most marginalized communities, in terms of what mental health and mental illness means, right? So it's an extra layer of getting access to that, not understanding that that is a part of your overall physical health, mental health, right, for the importance of it. I find that often in marginalized in communities that we really, it ends up displaying itself as physical symptoms, right? So they may complain more about problems with sleep or, you know, feeling stiff or sore or upset stomach feelings. But really at the root of it, it is anxiety or low mood. But it's just more culturally appropriate for them to call it a physical health issue. So I do think that there is always added layers. And the fact that a lot of people in our community don't think that you could be a quote-unquote good Muslim and have mental health issues, right? So they think that means that something is wrong with them in their faith, when that really, that doesn't come from our faith, right? That is just, it's just another layer of this, what you, part of your struggle is not a knock on you as a person. And really, in terms of religion, we're mandated to get help through the means that we've been provided, whether it be medication and or therapy. It is not just a, you know, pray harder and you'll be okay, which a lot of people in the Muslim community think that's what it is that you got to pray more. You're not praying good enough. It really is. You need to access help when you can and when it's necessary.
So in your time doing mental health work in any community, has there been any success moment or case where you were able to make a real difference that stands out for you?
I think there's all the little ones and there's the bigger ones, right? So recently I've been working with more younger populations, so younger meaning 20s. And to me, this work is exciting because you're working them earlier on in life, right? When you see people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, things have usually settled in, meaning the behaviors, the mindset has really kind of taken firm hold, and it's harder work. So when you're working with the younger population, which I've done more recently, it's just been amazing to kind of see how they can see now the connections with a little bit of poking and prodding and some questioning by me in terms of having them see that realization of themselves that they do have some control over how they're feeling, that they have some control over how they react to situations, whether it be, you know, this is what my mom is really doing this, she's bringing me down, but how to give them some of that control back in terms of you have the power to react to that in your way and how to bring about some of that. I think when I see them have the aha moment of, I see what you're saying. I'm saying one thing, but I'm doing something else. And how to really go about bringing that change in their lives. Because it's really what it's about is that, yes, life can suck at points, so there's these stressors, but what can you do about it in your limited means? You have control over how you react, right? So give them some of that power back. Because a lot of times we feel like we don't have any power or control. And it's to really show people how you can have some limited control and power in situations to give them that self-confidence back, to give them that strength, so they can, it makes it a bit easier, I think.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Call this my personal opinion if you must, but no matter where you come from, what you believe, if you have a disability, it's worth exploring what options are there for you. Don't get me wrong, faith always plays a role in healing and living at your best. It takes that faith, it takes that courage. No matter what you believe, no matter where you're coming from, it takes strength and character. And seeking help, seeking information, may be the best course of action. Just asking questions, trying to understand the nature of a disability, especially something like mental health. There are so very many myths out there. The truth is, the conditions aren't going to get better if we don't understand them and if we don't go beyond the surface. It's easy to say with any marginalized community, I don't want to look upon this because it's not what I'm comfortable with. We can do better, honestly. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.